Now, if we remember that Perseus's grandfather was involved, was a twin that was involved with rivalry and warfare and battling and things like that, and his great-grandfather was involved with, was a twin that was involved with rivalry and warfare and all of that, in that we have the whole idea of polarity, that the twins, they are twins because they are connected on a common pole of existence. And in that common pole of existence, the positive and negative ends of that pole are continuously struggling for dominance, because neither can be asserted at the same time. Like, you can't be electropositive and electronegative at the same time, because that represents a state of neutrality in which nothing is accomplished. And all of these struggles and battles and warfare and such like that are not to be taken as negatives. They're to be taken as the modus operandi for the way creation and manifestation and experience are brought to human beings in history. That is to say that it is not equality that makes for creativity. It is inequality and difference and the assertions in the state of inequality that allow things or make things to be done. And so the same thing is true of Electryon. He doesn't have a twin brother, but he fights with the locals in that part of the Greek peninsula, and he has trouble with his neighbors, and they are the, oh boy, I can't even pronounce the name, through a king named Pterlaos, the Taphians and the Teleboneans raid and steal these cows. Being an heir of the great king Perseus, he has a huge wealth of animals. And in the late Tarian era, the cow or the steers were always the symbol of wealth. You find in all the cultures, like among the Brahmins in India, they valued the wealth of something by how many cattle it was worth. And the same thing was true of the Egyptians, that the Egyptians weighed the value of something by how many cattle, because that was something that was living and it was worthwhile. It represented food, it represented luxury, it represented everything else. In fighting with the Teleboneans and the Taphians, all 8 sons are killed. And Electryon is left in a really bad way, and he goes off to try and find them and battle it out with them. But what happens, while he's gone, his, I better get the proper spelling right away, his nephew Amphitryon, leaves the kingdom in the hands of Amphitryon, and he says to him, rule well in my absence, and if you do so successfully, you can marry my daughter Alcmene. And so he goes off and he goes looking. I guess he has a few minor skirmishes and things like that, but he doesn't find the Taphians and the Teleboneans. He does not come home a conquering hero. But while he's gone, Amphitryon hears from the king of Elis, which is one of the communities in that same part of Greece, that he has cattle that originally belonged to Electryon, and that for a generous ransom, they can be bought back. So Amphitryon reaches deep into his purse, and he purchases all of the cattle of Electryon back. And then Electryon comes back from war, and Amphitryon comes to him and says, well, in your absence, I have found the source of all of the cattle and have bought them back, not the source of them, but where they're at now, and I have bought them back. Will you please repay me? And Electryon says, you bought stolen merchandise and you participated in such a fraud. I'm not going to pay you back for that. And and so they have a feud. The whole notion of fencing existed then, and property rights existed then, that nobody was supposed to take what was known to be stolen property or to purchase it, and to certainly not pay a ransom for it. And so Electryon says, well, you've ruled well in my absence, so you can have Alcmene as your wife, but you're not going to get money from me. And Amphitryon is very angry, and so what he does is one of the cows has strayed away from the herd. So he brought the herd for Electryon to say, yes, these are my cows. I guess this is before they branded cows. And he's so angry that he takes his club and he flings it at the cow that is separated away from the herd, and it lodges in the cow's horns, and it comes spinning back, and it bounces back, and it kills Electryon. And even... it's one of those things, the hidden thought is always there. No matter how hard you try to project it off onto something else, like an animal, it does what you were thinking in the first place. He was obviously very angry that he was going to lose his money. And so he just threw his club in a fit of pique or rage or upset or something like that, and he killed the very person he was battling with. However, that person happened to be a king, which was a regicide, and a regicide meant that he could no longer live in the kingdom. And it also happened to be his father-in-law, or his father-in-law-to-be, and so he was considered a defiled individual, and he had to go and clean himself up, and he was left to be an exile. Until such time that the gods declared him clean, he was left to be an exile. And so what happens is he goes to Thebes. And at Thebes, he finds great welcome with King Creon. Creon is the same one that took over the kingdom after Oedipus had blinded himself and himself took on exile. So Creon must have had some compassion for... Yes? No, thank you. And so he must have felt some remorse, and so he offers to, because only a king had powers in those days. A king was determined very often by a special tuft of hair on the back of the head. There were hereditary kingships, and kings in those days had spiritual powers. In fact, they had the ability to heal diseases and to do things of that nature. There's still, at least until the last century, there were ills that were called king's evils, because only kings could heal them. It had something to do with a genetic predisposition in certain physical lines that goes all the way back to things that were taught during the days of Atlantis, when the Mercurians and the people of Venus were here, and started the whole lines of divine kings, and a lot of those things stayed in the genetic makeup for quite a while. But at any rate, Creon purifies him and says, you're now free. You know, like, you're purified now, I as a king can do that. And on top of that, Creon actually gives his own daughter to Licymnius, I don't know how to pronounce it, as a wife. So it almost sounds like he's trying to buy himself into the kingdom. You know, so maybe it wasn't only just a matter of purification or something like that. However, Alcmene she's a tougher nut to crack than that. She marries Amphitryon, but she refuses to sleep with him. And she says, I will not sleep with you until my 8 brothers are revenged. And so Amphitryon goes back to his benefactor Creon, and he says to him, you know, I have this vengeance I have to honor in the same way that I had to seek for purification. Now I have to, for the regicide or the parricide, I also have to now cleanse myself or revenge myself through my wife for the loss of her brothers. And so Creon helps him again, and he gives him an army of Thebans and helps him to get an army from the Athenians and the Phocians and the Argives and the Locrians. And with a massive army, he goes out to the island. The Teleponians and the Taphians were island peoples, and they go out to the islands and they want them. But part of the deal is this is really complicated. There are all kinds of little stories within stories. Part of the deal is that Creon is having trouble with this vixen, this fox that comes into the city and is always stealing things from the city. Now, I don't understand the meaning of this part of the myth, but what happens is part of the deal is that for helping him put together this massive army, what happens is he has to get rid of the vixen. And so he goes to Athens, and then there's a famed hound in Athens, which is called Lelaps. And I don't know anything about it, but it was the famous hound of the ancient Greece. I don't know, it was the hound of heaven or what. And he gets the hound, and he hunts down the vixen, and kills it, and so he's sort of made part of the bargain with Creon. It's all very, very complicated. See, we're not talking about any of these people. We're trying to get to the person that we're going to be talking about for the next few weeks. it's a really strange topic. Now, we're going to be meeting every week now, but we're going to probably have shorter talks. They're probably going to be maybe only as short as an hour in length, and they're not going to be really long talks, because if I meet every week, I can't put together as much information as I would like to put together, and I think it's probably better that we go at a slower pace anyway. So at any rate, Creon is partly paid off, and he has now vanquished or avenged the death of the 8 grandchildren of Perseus, and he feels that he's in good shape. When he conquers the islands, he has an uncle named Helios, and he gives the government of the islands over to Helios. And so we've got sort of the prelude of the story ready. Now, what happens is, while the cat's away, the mice will play. It turns out that Alcmene is one of the most beautiful women on the earth, if not the most beautiful in that generation. And this doesn't escape Zeus. And Zeus was sort of a ladies' man. And he decides that while Amphitryon is gone, that he would like to sleep with Alcmene. But he understands, just by her demands already with her husband Amphitryon, he understands that she is quite virtuous. So she's not going to, even though he's a god, she's not going to give in to him. On the other hand, what Zeus has in mind, with her coming out of the family of Perseus, until then the most famous hero of all of Greece, what Zeus has in mind, he doesn't want to rape her either. So what he does is he makes himself appear as though he were Amphitryon. And what he does is he goes to the other Helios, the one who drives the chariot of the sun, and he tells him, for 3 days I want you to stay home and not come out. I want a night that lasts 3 days long. And Helios grumbles and says, geez, it was so much better in the good old days when night was night and day was day, and when Kronos ruled, there wasn't all of this, what would you call it, womanizing. And he grumbles about it because Zeus was almighty, and it stays night for that long period. And on top of that, he commands Hermes to get a hold of the moon and slow the moon down. And the notion that the Greeks had, and this is something in the myth that I didn't get time to ponder quickly enough to have insight on, but he has Hermes slow the moon down because if the moon is slowed down, then the people will be more drowsy and sleep more. And see what he has, the way Zeus puts it, he says what he has in mind must not be accomplished in haste. And so he wants to spend a good long night with no bother of any kind. And so what happens, he appears to Alcmene, and he appears as Amphitryon, and with his foreknowledge, he knows all of the details of the war before the war is even fought. And so he appears to her and starts telling her war stories. And he sports with her the entire night. Now we have a lot of things to talk about here. Now, Alcmene was the last human that Zeus ever mated with. And she was actually an heir to the first woman. So here we have Zeus, which means Albright. And the first woman he ever, human that he ever mated with, was Niobe. You're familiar with the story of Niobe. She was a beautiful, beautiful woman, and Zeus mated with her a number of times, and they had a number of children. They were the famous Niobes. Only Niobe became, I don't know, Niobe or Niobe, she became so vain about the beauty of her children that she said that they were as beautiful as Apollo and Artemis. And Apollo took great vengeance at this, and he thought that anybody would think his children were that beautiful. So what he does is he goes out and with his solar chariot, he's famous for his archery. Both Artemis and Apollo were famous for their archery, and he, with his bow and arrow, kills all of the children, all of the Niobes he kills. And this is part of a famous poem that Moore, the British poet, wrote about. It's quoted frequently in the history of poetry because Moore liked good poetry and disliked poor poets, and he very much disliked doctors. You know the story. It's in Bull Finch's mythology. It comes up quite often. And it turns out that in his time there was a doctor named Richard Blackmore. And Richard Blackmore was a doctor that wrote bad poetry. Such that he wrote sort of like, I'm hooked up here. Would somebody go out and the front door is wide open? I guess the kid must have left the door wide open. No. She lived to, the gods always do things in a grand style. She lived to grieve her her bad discretion. Yes.
You should tell us that right
again. Oh, okay. Yeah. And so it turned out then that Moore, the poet, wrote the little ditty. I think I remember it. 'Twas from his carriage the sublime Sir Richard Blackmore used to rhyme. Like Phoebus in his car at ease, now warbling forth a lofty song, now murdering young Niobes. he got to take pot shots both at bad poetry and doctors within one little ditty. But the 16th generation from Niobe is Alcmene. Now, the Neoplatonists, we won't go into this, but remember last year when we were talking about the way the Neoplatonists talked about different kinds of consciousness, the way it is used, like, for example, when Zeus mated with his mother, Rhea. That is, when you associate your consciousness with something higher than it, that is one kind of, that's one kind of creative activity. I don't remember all of the terms for these. However, with his equal, when he made it with Demeter, it is another kind of creativity. There's a different kind of thing that is effected in the cosmos when the spiritual force that is represented by Zeus interacts with an equal. In this case, when he interacts with an inferior like Alcmene or Niobe, what happens is something else is affected. Now, this number of 16, it was only 16 that he mated with. And that happens to be exactly the number of subdivisions that could be called races in humanity, such that the first one was in Lemuria, 7 in Atlantis, 7 in Ariana, and 1 in, let's call it, Galilea. This is relating to Zeus as what the Gnostics would call the Demiurgos, or what we would refer to as the Holy Ghost in Christian mysticism, is drawing from the cosmic archetype. And these so-called races are forms and they are types through which different kinds of differential experience are obtained. And so the mating of Zeus with the 16 generations represents to the mystic that there are 16 states or 16 specific somatic types of experiences that are expected that a human being is going to live through to come through a complete experience of the material world, the external world, and to the complete experience as a human being. And so that gets cloaked in mysticism by the constant reunion of Zeus with different females to produce archetypal human beings, and each of those archetypal human beings then is like a founder of a race, and the founder of a race is there from the beginning and is also, when things get decadent, is a savior. Because when we're talking about heroes, heroes are there, are always considered Alpha and Omega. They're there at the beginning, they're there at the end. They're the founders, they're the seminal beings that start the activity, but they're also the saviors that redeem. And this is, if we look at this, the way we're looking at this is we're saying that each of us is aspiring to initiation. Each of us is aspiring to be a hero or heroine in ourselves, and that we're aspiring to complete the whole work of creation, and in so do it, save not only ourselves. This is not a personal salvation, but it is, since we are microcosms of the entire cosmos, that when we go through the entire enlightenment experience and create the cosmos, we create our own version of it, which is completing part of the big picture. It's part of our divine duty. So in effect, each one of us are redeemers and are saviors of the entire cosmos. And so the it seems like a bunch of philandering and lascivious or salacious sporting on the part of Zeus actually is pointing to something that is quite meaningful. So this, the whole idea, this is, it's portrayed in different traditions in different ways. For example, in the Hindu tradition, they're called incarnations of Vishnu. In the Buddhist tradition, they're called Buddhas. In another tradition, they're called Manu. That's the one that's also from the Sanskrit. But the savior, Manu, if you take, for example, the book of Exodus in the Bible, and every place where you see Egypt, take it out and put in Atlantis, and every place where you see Moses, put in Manu, and you can read the Exodus story. The parting of the waters is actually the parting of the falling rain, and the promised land is actually, we're all living in the promised land because it was promised, because we couldn't even see it in the Atlantean epoch because we were, the whole atmosphere of the earth was still foggy yet because the surface was hot and everything was steamy. And we didn't even have the vision like we had now, and the whole process of the three floods of Noah, or the three deluges, the floods of Noah and Moses, represent a coming out of the Atlantean period into the air-breathing, the Ariana period. And so what we're talking about then in these heroes, or these individuals that are leaders, that are founders, or that are saviors or redeemers, they're one and the same being. It's the whole idea that there are central archetypal human beings. And the archetypal human beings are the beings that represent for each stage that humans go through, each condition which has its inherent lessons in it, because each culture that is associated with a race has its own language, and when you speak a certain type of language, there are only certain kinds of emotions. Like if you listen to a Romance language, it's altogether different than listening to a language with a lot of stops in it, such as German or Russian or something like that. Or if you take a language like the Eskimos speak, which is almost all vowels, that's almost a Lemurian-like language. It's all vowels and no consonants. What you experience in your consciousness when you learn that kind of language, or like take a person who eats nothing but fruits versus a person who eats basically rice or grain versus somebody who eats Hasenpfeffer, it's a different kind of experience. Or the fact that some people wore nothing but sheets wrapped around them, others wore robes, and still others wore mail. And this has got to be a totally different kind of experience. So each of these special beings, each of the 16 beings, represents the archetypal hero, somebody that people will look up to and somebody that people will admire. And in their admiration, they will emulate that because they somehow see that this person represents the ideal of the kind of experience that they're living through. In the center, somewhere here in the center of Ariana, is the archetypal human being of all archetypal human beings, who becomes the leader for all humanity, and that is the person who most represents the human condition in the humble acceptance of the earthly state. And in that humble acceptance, is able to unite with the center of the archetype of the whole cosmos. In the Christian tradition, we call that being Jesus, but that human being need not even have a name. All you have to realize is that there is a central person that represents the human condition, and that by attuning ourselves to the human condition in that way, we can, through that being and accepting that being as a leader, that we can attune ourselves to the whole human condition in all of its different variations, the whole rainbow, the whole spectrum. And so we're trying to get to the whole thing. Now we also have something else. There are a number of things that take place in this. If we understand that Helios is required to stay at home for 3 days, that means 3 days of darkness. And if you'll remember the very first tale that we looked at, the heroine in East of the Sun and West of the Moon, everything that she accomplished in the land that was East of the Sun and West of the Moon was as far as the north wind could drive her. The hero was taken down to there that she was to save. And that means that it is like this was a solstice story, when the wind had been pushed as far, the sun had been pushed as far south as it could go. And it looks then like the savior that is being produced by the union of Zeus and Alcmene is also solstically conceived, because his conception takes place on three dark nights. And the three dark nights of solstice are the longest nights of the year. See, because normally when you read a story like this, the information that's in the story is very tricky, the way that it's hidden. Very, very tricky, and you have to dig to get it out. So what happens is, he is with her for a three-day night, and she conceives, but doesn't know it yet. And then what happens the next day? Amphitryon comes home, and he starts telling her the story of the war, and tries to coax her to the marriage bed, And she looks at him as if he's crazy. And she said, "We didn't sleep a wink last night, and you expect me, what kind of a braggart are you? You expect me to listen to those stories all over again?" And Amphitryon is befuddled, and he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't at all know what to do. So what the Greeks did, when they got into trouble, they either went to an oracle or they went to a wise man. And what Amphitryon did was the latter. He went to Greece, and he sought out a seer that was named Tiresias. Now, Tiresias was a most interesting man. He liked to take walks in the hills. He was a Theban. He liked to take walks in the hills outside of Thebes, and he took his walking stick with him. And one day when he's walking along, he sees two snakes copulating. And he sticks his walking stick in between them, and he has a vision, and he remembers his most recent incarnation when he was a woman, which is fine. And another day, he's out walking again, and of all things, he finds snakes copulating again. And he does the same thing. He sticks his stick in between the snakes, and he has a vision of the incarnation before that, when he was a man. And about that time, Zeus and his wife Hera were having an argument about who... Good evening, huh? You missed all the good stuff already. We just have all the dregs. We're having a short class tonight. And what happened is Zeus and Hera were battling about who enjoys sex more. And they said, "Now we finally can settle this issue. We'll go and we'll see Tiresias, who remembers his two past lives, the most recent one as a woman and the one before that as a man. And since he remembers those lives clearly, he'll be able to tell us which way he enjoyed it the most." Tiresias, you understand what this means. The stick, when he finds the serpents out, when he's out for a walk, and he sticks his stick in between them, those are obviously, that's shorthand for saying that this is the caduceus of Mercury, where there's the white snake and the black snake wrapped around the stick, and this is the whole symbol of the whole evolution. And wherever these snakes meet is a juncture point, is like one of these spots where a new race is born, or when Zeus unites with a mortal again. That's a special point, and that represents an initiatory type of step. And so what happens is that each of the occasions when he's out walking and puts his stick between the copulating serpents represents an initiatory state. Now, the initiate is never supposed to lie. For the sake of not harming people, he cannot tell something. He can remain silent, but he can never lie. But Tiresias, though he was an initiate, didn't realize what kind of a position he was putting himself in. He just should have said, "I don't want to judge that." But here the gods are before him, and they ask him, and he's honest. And he said, "As I recall it," he agrees with modern sexology, "the woman appreciates it more than the man does." And Zeus got so angry with him that he struck him blind. And Hera, on the other hand, because she couldn't undo what Zeus had done, there's sort of an honor among gods that they won't undo what the other one does, but what they can do is they can give a boon instead. And the boon that she gave him was seership, especially the seership where he could, with his inner vision, he could hear the birds fly, which means he could read thoughts. And this is how he came to know truth. So Amphitryon is befuddled. He doesn't, you know why his wife told him that they had been sleeping together all night when he was still at war. And he asks Tiresias, what's going on here? And Tiresias tells him the truth, that while you were gone, Zeus appeared looking like you and slept with your wife, and he's trying to conceive a great hero, the greatest hero of all. And that is what has happened. Now, Amphitryon was a little upset about this, but he wasn't a dummy. And so what he thought is, I better not ever sleep with my wife again. And so he never did. So she had one union in her entire life with the divinity, and that was it. Do you see what this is? This is the way the Greeks tell the story. Now, this is another backdoor thing. In the same way as Helios holding the sun for 3 days in the shed, or leaving the team in the shed and not bringing the sun across the heavens, indicates that this is a solstice conception. But the fact that the husband never sleeps with his wife and the only one who does is a god is a tricky way of saying the same thing that happens with all of the other great heroes and saviors that are born, is that they're born of a virgin. Clearly, she was a virgin, and she could say, just as Mary said, I know no man, because it was a god that she had united with. Now, this comes up with a theme of another type. I guess we'll carry it out a little further later on. So the hero has now been conceived, and conceived again by the third in line of the gods. If you remember the story of the creation, first there was Uranus, and then Uranus had Cronus, and then Zeus was the son of Cronus. And so this is a child that was conceived by the third and was conceived on a three-day night. And it's the same as saying in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that the most elementary completion in space, the simplest figure in any number of dimensions that objectifies space between the subjective unknown and the captured known, is the three. So there is a great three kind of completion. And what this is talking about is a theme that we've talked about again and again and again in these talks, is that the true hero is a threefold spirit. That the self, that the true part of our being, the divine part of our being, that is the hero that we unfold to, or that we awaken in ourselves and become, is the hero. Now, even though Tiresias made the mistake of answering the question when he was judged, he's not to be blamed, because even Zeus does the same kind of thing. I'm going to turn this over. I guess we go a little bit yet. Because 9 months later, on the due date, Zeus is in Olympus and he starts bragging. And he said that today, and he's bragging, Zeus starts bragging, and when he does so, everything that he does is a pronouncement. If you have that much power, your words become self-fulfilling prophecies. They indeed become facts. And he said, today, in the house of Perseus, is going to be born a new king. And he will rule the house of Perseus. And that is the truth that he has proclaimed. And he's asked what's going to go on, and he says, well, it's going to be somebody that is going to be called the glory of Hera. And that means Heracles. This is the way Hercules is the Latin, and since they were borrowers, we won't use their name, we'll use the Greek Heracles. Heracles then means the glory of Hera. Now, Zeus gets nabbed for his bragging. Bragging always seems to indicate insecurity or overconfidence that is the result of insecurity. And there's always a proof of that, that you're not as good as your boast is to be. Because if you've got those powers, and you're secure in yourself, you don't have to brag. What you are stands for itself. So word gets around to Hera, and she hears about it, and she's jealous. Here he's been messing around again, so she's going to teach him a lesson. And what she does is she goes to a woman named Nikippe, the wife of King Sthenelus. And she is 7 months pregnant. And what she does is sort of tweaks her so that she's going to deliver early. In the meantime, she goes before Alcmene's door, and she sits there squat-legged with her legs crossed, and she ties all of her clothing in knots, and she crosses her hands like this. And this act keeps her so that Alcmene can't deliver. And so what happens is some people claim that he's delayed 1 day, or some people claim that he's delayed 1 hour. But when he does show up in the morning, there's already somebody in the crib, and that is... Ichthys, is that how it goes? No, not Ichthys, Iphicles. Yes, Iphicles and Heracles. All right. So it turns out that, now this is where the story becomes very blurred. And that's very important in mythology, because things in mythology are so, the really big things are so big that there's always confusion about them. There are confusions about births, and there are confusions about deaths. Like, who was Shakespeare, or how did John Kennedy die? Well, all of those things are, they become very mythical issues. And obviously the birth of a hero is something that has many, you know, there are many factors that lead up to this, because the hero represents, you know, like if that happens to be a hero that represents one of the forms of experience that is the central representative, that culture has all sorts of things. It has a language, and it has a food, and it has ways of clothing, and ways of traveling, and ways of building houses, and things like that. Like most of the Aryan nations use the triangle on top of the square to build their houses. Whereas other people use different geometric forms. You know, other people use like teepees or something like that. And there are a whole bunch of things. Now, the whole story then about the birth of Heracles and Iphicles becomes obscured between all kinds of different variations. At first, his name, the name of Heracles, is Alkes or Palamon. Now that's the birth name. And in this, and then later on, after he has done his 12 labors, we'll come to that in a little bit tonight, and in several weeks from tonight, we'll spend a lot of time on it. So he's given one name at birth, and then after he has accomplished his 12 labors and becomes divine, and becomes a god, then he has the name Heracles. And this is also something that is very true in all spiritual traditions. Because when we are here in the material world, and when we have fallen in the material world in such a way that we have lost direct connection with our divine estate, we have developed a different kind of consciousness. We've developed a brain-mind consciousness where we look at all of the illusory viewpoints that crop up in the material world. If you look at somebody straight on, you get a different image than if you look from that side or from the top down. And so that kind of consciousness has entered us, and we have a very fragmented kind of consciousness, and that is in our language. Our words, when we understand something that is universal and spiritual, our material world words don't answer to it. And the same is true of the names we give. We give names that have a material name. But when a person comes into the true spiritual nature, then their name resonates from them as part of their character. For example, this is in the American Indian times, when a man comes into manhood and he goes through all of his trials and his character comes out, then the old wise ones give him his name according to his character. Now that's a tradition. But there's something that carries even further. Like if we look at the book that is most the book of initiation in the Bible, if we look in the book of Revelation, it says, "He that overcometh, I will give a new name." And that is to say, that is, our name is the same or a variation, a very close variation of the name of God. And so it's the same with Heracles, and it's the same with us, that as we come into our true being, we come to know our true name, which is the name of God, which is a variation of the word that has produced the entire creation, especially the entire creation as we have participated in it. So when we discover our new name, we gain the lost word, and we become a spiritual power. So the story of Heracles is the same kind of story. Now, the thing is that Hera is also kind of smug, and she goes back to Olympus, and she said, "I have been able to keep Eileithra from the door." This is the goddess of childbirth, is called Eileithra. The goddess of childbirth, she kept her from the door, and in her bragging, she got herself into trouble. Her favorite and oldest daughter by Zeus, who is called Eight, she was an accomplice in all of this. Because while Hera was delaying the birth of Heracles, at first called Palamon, while Hera is doing that, it is distracting him so that he doesn't know what's going on. And he gets so angry that he grabs her by the hair and he throws her down to earth. And when he throws her down to earth, she's banished there for life, and she can never more go back to Olympus. Obviously, this is talking, this is the firstborn of Zeus and Hera, which represents, since these are equals, this is not like Zeus, this is Zeus mating with his counterpart, not with his mother, which would be a higher state of consciousness, or Niobe, or Alcmene, which would be a lower state of consciousness, but the essential nature, the firstborn daughter, which would represent the essential feminine receptive nature, is brought down to earth in the same act that Heracles is born by. And since the feminine represents the receptivity, this is at the same time that a hero is born who is obviously a monster conqueror type of hero. The essential feminine nature is also brought to earth at the same time, which is a very soft receptivity, the ability to draw things in and hold things in. So the, you know, so all these little innuendos that come into the story also have their meanings. Okay, now Zeus can't go back on his word. He said that there will be a king that is born to the house of Perseus on this day. And since it appears, and there was always the principle that the firstborn was to be the king. And because he was tricked by Heracles, Iphicles has to be the king. So Zeus goes and he bargains, you know, after having thrown it down to earth, he goes and he bargains and he talks with Hera and he says, you see, I'm all potent. You've got to come to terms with me. And he talks her into it and persuades it that if Heracles performs 12 tasks, that Eurystheus puts before him. Eurystheus, we'd have to go all the way back up into Perseus' lineage. We'll come to that later again. Eurystheus is, if you remember all of the, remember when we talked about the Hesperides and all of those, that lineage of Atlas and Cleon and all of those people. Yeah, it's very complicated. You've walked into something that you don't know how complicated it is. And I'm simplifying it because to try and hold all of Greek mythology, especially all of the intermeanings, it's almost as complicated as what it represents, which is the spiritual worlds. And the spiritual worlds, there is so much truth and there is so much interaction and there are so many connections because everything is in everything and it's all tied together and there are many different sides to everything we're experiencing, that the mythology that represents it so that people are prepared to receive, because most people, when they start having clairvoyant experiences or out-of-the-body experiences, it's totally overwhelming to them. They're as befuddled as Amphitryon was, because it takes a long time before you can get any equilibrium, because you're dazed. The first thing that happens is everything is so beautiful that you're in tears all the time. And that's why you have to have the ability to have a stern control over yourself, because everything is so beautiful and so wonderful that you lose your composure in that way. But at any rate, we'll come back to Eurystheus at another time. But the deal, he's the grandson that is a musician of Tantalus. Remember the very first talk 2 years ago when we talked, second talk when we talked about Tantalus? After Heracles does these 12 feats, and they're all acts of service, then he will be called Heracles, the glory of Hera. And then he will become a god in full right. Now we have something really interesting to look at here, because for several weeks now, and even a little bit tonight, we've been looking at twins, rival twins that fight. And we've been talking about, on the one hand, we've been talking about horizontal twins, twins that are of equal value, just that one represents the positive pole and one represents the negative pole, and that in their struggles and interactions with each other is how change comes about in the cosmos. But now let's look at twins in a different light, because one of these twins is truly spiritual. Heracles is truly spiritual, where Iphicles is truly mortal and earthly. So in this case, we have a vertical pole, where we have a positive and a negative pole, and there's an equal structure. Now, the firstborn is always to rule the earth. And the firstborn represents something that's at the ground floor. Something that is, you know, like when something is first presented, it may not be the most perfect. It may have to go through many additions to come to a state of perfection. But when it's first presented, it represents the essential condition. Just like the very first breath that we take is how the cosmic forces are stamped onto our body, and that's what makes our horoscope work. We're born at a time when we can take the first breath so that we can be in full harmony with the cosmos. And so that's where the whole idea of the firstborn being the ruler comes in, because it represents something that is very primal, something very fundamental, something that is right from the beginning. But the firstborn, as we have seen in every fairy tale and every hero story that we've looked at, the firstborn, unless it was the only born, was not the one who became the spiritual hero or heroine. It was always the last born, because the last born is the final edition, and it represents the most fresh flow of the newest quality of the spirit. So like where the firstborn is more like a founder, a savior who saves and redeems everything that has come from before by being the complete perfection of it, and that is capable of carrying it into a new realm, into a spiritual realm, is the lastborn. So in this case, the firstborn is Iphicles, and the lastborn is Heracles. And so we have the ruler of the earth was always called, it comes from Irish mythology and Irish government, because they had their early government was based on mythology. The ruler that ruled the material half of the year was always called the Tanis. So you had two kings. You had for the material half of the year, usually which was from the beginning of Aries to the end of Virgo, that was ruled by the Tanis. Whereas the spiritual king ruled the spiritual half of the year, the winter half of the year. Now this is a very interesting notion, because I like the whole idea a lot, because it's a way of dealing with the division of church and state, of dealing with spirit and matter, where you have a spiritual being in charge of spiritual things and a material being in charge of material things. But the way we want to look at this really is that when we're looking at Heracles, that is our model. Heracles is the hero. That is who we are trying to become like. And in ourselves, the vertical is the spiritual. And what is being said here in all of these myths, you look at any hero, the father is always invisible. This is true from the mythology of Christianity. No one has ever seen the father. Christ says, I am, in the three members of the Spirit, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The deepest part of the Godhead is always invisible. It represents the invisible power. But that invisible power becomes manifest as light in the second member. And then that gets broken up into color in the third member, such that there are all sorts of different flavors, and you have the seven rays, and you have rainbows of people and such like that. But in all spiritual heroes that are born, there is always an invisible father. And the invisible father is usually divine. There is some confusion with the material father, and so that there is usually a twin, and that twin is a Tanist or the material part. Now, if we look at ourselves, it's just like Paul says in the Bible. There's one man, one law in me that is a law of matter, and it does what it wants, and then there's another law in me that is divine. And if we look at our true character is indeed a dichotomy. We have a lower personal self, which is kind of scheming and looks to the values of the earth, and it rules the things of the earth. And whereas in the inner part of ourselves, in our deepest inmost nature, which when we are in touch with it, seems almost not even to be us because it's so divine and it seems so wonderful that it's beyond us that we could even be anything like that, that is like the relationship between Heracles and Iphicles. And the process of looking at a hero is not only centering on somebody that represents the essential condition of the cultural state that you're going through, but it also represents a focus on the central spiritual part of self that we are trying to rise to, and that we are trying to bring the, instead of having fighting brothers, like Castor and Polydeuces. One of them was mortal and one of them was immortal. And the same thing with Jacob and Esau. One got to be the divine ruler and the other was an ordinary human. And so what we're trying to do, instead of struggle and fight between the higher and lower self, we're trying to bring that it quality of the lower self to work in harmony and receptive humility, and to be the questioner, either questioning by perception, saying, what is that? Or asking questions, what does that mean? And that questioning has a hollow type of quality, vacuous quality that is at the heart of our thinking. And when we ask those types of questions, then the answer comes from the divine part of our being. And what we're talking about here, when we're talking about heroes and their twins, the spiritual and material governance, we're talking about the relationship in a human and a harmony that eventually comes out of it. All right, I guess we've looked at all of those sorts of things. All right, now we're going to look at, we're almost done. Now we're coming to all the really odd, curious things. Yes? I don't know. I will look it up and try and... Nothing has ever heard of them again. In many cases, yeah, that's right. After the first day, you hear almost nothing of him. In order to allow him to rule, Heracles goes wandering all over the world. We're going to hear, he'll come up, Iphicles will come up a little bit next week when we talk about the childhood of Heracles and such like that. But, all right, I'll have to remind myself to look up and see what the name means. Now, there are variations on the birth story. There are always variations. And some say that Hera tried to indefinitely extend the travail so that Heracles couldn't be born. And that wouldn't be allowable. And Tiresias figures in this variation of the story, Tiresias figures in, and since he had a part in exposing the whole business, his daughter went to the birth chamber and attended to Alcmene. His daughter was Historis. I don't know if that's where hysterectomy comes from or not. I wouldn't know whether to say. But she was in the birth chamber. And she sees Hera outside with the legs crossed and the fingers crossed and the clothes all in knots. And she is very, very clever. And what happens is that she goes back into the birth chamber, and after a little while, she instructs all of the other maids that are around to follow like her, like what she does. And then she lets out this great big cry of joy that the child has been born. And this so fools Hera, that divine as she is, she is fooled by it. And she says, "Well, what did I do wrong?" She gets up and walks away. When she gets up and leaves her hands unknotted and her feet unknotted, then Heracles is born and the infinite travail is kept away. You remember the story that when we talked about Susanoo, the Japanese hero? Remember that we had that little side story about the Sun Queen that hid herself in a cave and wouldn't come out, and then they put the mirror out in front of the cave, and then everybody started laughing as though there were great joy, and then she came and peeped out. Same story, same principle that is there, and the same interpretation works there, but we don't want to go into it all over again. Now, other people have other stories, and they get involved with rivalries, like the Thebans and the Athenians both claim a part of Heracles, and the Thebans claim that the goddess of birth herself, Elythra, I guess that's, would you pronounce it that way, Elythra? All right, Elythra did the hindering, and she's the one that crossed her hands and legs and folded her knuckles together and kept Alcmene from delivering. But there was a young woman called Galanthus, or sometimes Galen for short, that she did something similar. She came out and she announced the birth of the child. She came out of the chamber, and then Elythra was the one that was fooled, and the child was allowed to be born. And Elythra became so enraged by this that she turned Galanthus into a weasel. And that's significant. We'll come to that in just a second. The Athenians, who always tried to deride the Thebans, they said, no, that Galanthus was really a harlot, and for her whoring around, she was turned into a weasel, because weasels are supposed to be very prolific. And that when she was turned into a weasel, she just happened to be running by Elythra and frightened her, and she jumped up, and that's what caused the birth. Now, when somebody, the lore, the biological lore of the Greeks was that weasels were viviparous, which means, I think that's how the word is spelled, you know, yeah. That means that you give birth to your children out of your mouth. The tradition came that because weasels, like cats, will take their very young and carry them around in their mouth for protection, that they would say that the bumpkins believed then that the weasels gave birth to I have to tell you this, that the whole notion of the mouth and the sex organs is tied up in a lot of creative mythology. There are people that believe that you can conceive by a potent kiss, and that some animals actually do it that way. I actually believed that for a while. I'm a fool that I'll believe anything. But this is a very, very important thing, because a viviparous birth means, is another way of saying, this is really tricky, you gotta read between the lines, a viviparous birth indicates that something is word-born. Remember the shout that came from the birth chamber? That is the shout of joy that accompanies the birth, and that is the whole notion. Founders are usually born of the womb. Firstborns who represent the material side of things are of the earth, earthly, and therefore they come in through the northern gate. They're born through the womb. But at the end, at the 16th, remember we said that there were 16 generations, the human condition, where we're going to be divided into specialized groups to learn specialized kinds of experience, or when we pass through all of these 16 stages, after this, we'll all be unified. And in that unity, we won't have to be divided psychologically, and we won't have to even be divided physically. And we will then be able to, remember when Jesus says in the body of John the Baptist, he says, of those born of women, there is none purer than John the Baptist. Now that's a very curious way to say it. That's saying that there is another way to be born. And that other way to be born is to be word born. And this has a higher spiritual symbolic meaning, and it actually has a physical meaning. The being born of the word rather than being born of the divided birth consciousness means that we're not born in the Holy Spirit, which is where you give names. You know, like the Father is associated with meanings or definitions. The Son is associated with words because words bear the meaning. But when they become personalized and become selves, the Holy Spirit becomes a name. And when that name becomes the name of all names, it becomes associated with the Word. And to be born in the Word means not to receive the baptism of the Holy Spirit, but the higher baptism, the baptism of the Christ consciousness, to be word-born. That's on one level of what it means. But when you reach that state of consciousness, since the realm of the life spirit is a realm of pure creativity, Le Comte de Saint-Germain, who could draw from that region of life spirit, was known to say in the court of Louis XVI, in the same way that God can take the stuff of space and create new things, I can. Which some people thought was a tremendously braggadocious statement, but for him it was just a simple statement of fact. And it turns out that in a state of evolution, that when you've passed through all of the separative conditions, and you've seen it from all of these points of view, and you assimilate that into the unity of your consciousness, you approach the state where you have a creative unity in yourself, which is like it was before the times of Adam and Eve, before we were split into sexes. Because remember, Adam and Eve created the animals, or they created the forms of the animals by naming them. And by throwing off the animal forms to become human-like, they did this they emanated them from them as words or as names, and those names actually produced the animal forms that are the different species and families of animals that we have in the world right now. But now, when we return to that Melchizedek type of state in the Galilean consciousness, which is at the end of the divided human state, we will then have that creativity that it's just as, when Christ is asked in the kingdom of heaven, who's going to be married to somebody. You know, remember the story of a woman who was married to each of the seven brothers by law, and each one died off in the kingdom of heaven. Which one will she be married to? And Christ says, don't you know, it's written that in the kingdom of heaven that they are not given, they are like the angels, and they are not given in marriage, which means to say that bodies are going to be created in a different way, and they won't be born of women, but they will be word-born. And so what they're talking to, when Heracles represents the birth of the 16th generation of Zeus mating with humans, Heracles is pointing to that future state as a central hero when we will all be viviparous and we will all be word-born. So in all of this weasel talk and stuff like that, the most crazy stuff, there are hints to all kinds of strange things. At any rate, Heracles got born. And he has an unusual birthday because the Greeks celebrated his birthday on the fourth day of every month. This has to do with the fact that he was actually a 12-month baby, because this is another thing where there are variations. Some of the ancients claim that he was born when the sun entered the 10th sign, Capricorn. And all saviors are born at the winter solstice. And if he was conceived at the winter solstice and he was born at the winter solstice, we're talking about a spiritual birth, that means he is a full cycle person. And his whole life is that. His first birth, which is the physical birth to Alcmene, was a 12-month birth, but when he completes the 12 labors and becomes a god, that is his second birth, and that is also a 12-month labor because there are the 12 things that he has to accomplish. So you can see that what we're saying here, when you're talking about a 12-month baby versus a 9-month baby or a 7-month baby, when you're talking about that, you're talking about something that has all 12 points of view from all of the signs of the zodiac, and it's a full cycle kind of consciousness, and it isn't limited to just one point of view, which is why we're supposed to have 12 people on a jury, because there's supposed to be one from each sign of the zodiac, and you'll have all 12 points of view. Others claim that when he was born, that the great bear at midnight was straight north, but proceeding west over the constellation of Orion, which would mean that Heracles was born in the beginning of Aries, which would throw light onto, there's a tradition that says, and Zeus shined light on his cradle, meaning to say that this is the first time that the days are longer than the nights, which would also tend to say then that Heracles became both eventually the ruler of heaven and earth, because he had lived an earthly existence and had conquered, because cycles of time begin when the sun is in Capricorn. That is the beginning of the spiritual year, and the beginning of the material year is in Aries, when at that time in history, the great bear was in the north over the constellation of Orion. It's now, because of the precession of equinox, it's a little different than that. So we can see by all of this that he was a 12-month child, and this is, you know, from this we can also determine a number of other things. That other heroes have had the same thing. Like for example, the installation of the Grand Master in masonry, the one who represents Hiram, he is always killed with a hammer. He's always killed with a hammer at winter solstice, and then a new Hiram takes over. But the new Hiram doesn't pound the hammer. This is the hammer. It's a claw hammer. The hammer isn't pounded until the first day of spring. In fact, even the death of the Hiram doesn't begin to happen until here, when he meets three Jubilee, Jubilah, and Jubilo, the three bandits that eventually hit him over the head with the hammer. And those Jubilee, Jubilah, and Jubilo are the three Zubin stars, if you're familiar. They're mispronunciations of the Zubin stars in the constellation of Libra. And so that the hammer that he gets hit in the head with happens at winter solstice, and the new Hiram or Heracles calls order into the world in the first of... You see what I'm trying to say? That this is all a solar myth. And we've been looking at sidereal myths all along, and we're going to look at this as being a special hero myth, because we're going to look at all of them that way, but because the sun is a star And for us, the sun is the most important star. It is the central most of the stars to us. It is the source, and it is the destination, and it is the goal, and it is the purpose of all of our existence. We might say that the sun represents the outer garment of the divine. And we know from astrology that the sun represents self, and self is the hero that we're pointing to. And so when we're looking at the myth of Heracles, and probably for all the rest of the semester, the three myths that we're going to look at, we're going to be looking at attaining to selfhood in the spirit, and we're going to be looking at that, at the sun being the star's star, because it outshines all of the rest. And we know that in our inner consciousness, we have all of these many different eyes. Sometimes we feel like, oh, I'm a coward. And other times we feel like I'm a great lover. But eventually they all have to pass away at dawn when the real sun is born, when the real star is born, and we have this central most self, which is the divine, the godlike part of ourselves, which unifies and washes away all of the stars so that they're invisible. And in that regard is the way we're going to be looking at Heracles. And so Heracles, even as the hero's hero, the way we're going to look at it, has to have something to emulate. So Heracles emulates the sun. The 12 labors of Heracles are the labors of the sun, as when Apollo wrestled with the great serpent Apollo Pythias, like on the diagram, which are the 12 signs of the zodiac laid out as the ecliptic relative to the celestial equator. All right, we've had an introduction, and next time we'll talk about the childhood and some of the early exploits of Heracles, and then somewhere in there we'll talk about the 12 labors and a number of ancillary topics, of course. And then we'll talk about the death of Heracles and move on to another myth after that. Well, I didn't get it in an hour, but...